You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Greetings. I'm Andre Perry, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and I welcome you to the Brookings event Examining the Effects of Student Debt Cancellation, featuring Senator Charles Schumer, as well as notable experts and practitioners in the field, including Beth Akers, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, Braxton Brewington, press secretary of the nonprofit The Debt Collective, Marshall Steinbaum, senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute, and he's assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah. And we'll also be joined by my research assistant, Carl Romer, with Brookings, as well as Braxton Simpson, an HBCU fellow at RISE. You know, Americans like to think that if individuals are educated in great schools, they can pull themselves up by their proverbial bootstraps and bring their families with them. From childhood, we're told that we can achieve middle-class status if we work hard in school and get good grades, no matter if obstacles such as bad policing, weak labor markets, and discriminatory housing policies litter our path. We believe that a good education can propel us past those barriers and we can surpass our parents' social standing. But many Black college graduates are not surpassing their parents in wealth and improving their chances of achieving the American dream. The reality is that wealth, not education, is the differentiating factor. We're going to explore this issue in depth. First, we will hear from Senator Charles Schumer of New York, who's working with Elizabeth Warren, who are pressing for up to $50,000 of debt cancellation. After Schumer's presentation, we'll hear a conversation between recent graduates, Carl Romer, who graduated from Howard, and Braxton Simpson, who graduated from Tennessee State University. Then I will moderate what I expect to be a lively panel featuring Beth Akers of the American Enterprise Institute, Braxton Brewington, with the Debt Collective, and Marshall Steinbaum of the Jane Family Institute. I encourage viewers to engage the conversation by tweeting your questions to @BrookingsMetro using the hashtag StudentDebt or by emailing events@brookings.edu. Again, you can email your or you can tweet your questions to @BrookingsMetro using the hashtags using the hashtag StudentDebt or by emailing events@brookings.edu. So let's get started. It's with great pleasure I introduce Senator Charles Schumer.
Hello, Brookings. This is Senator Chuck Schumer, and thank you for letting me join your virtual event on student debt cancellation. This topic is so, so important to me, and I believe there's never been a better time to take action. For generations, higher education has been a ladder up into the middle class, especially for Black, Latino, and Asian Americans. But for too many today, student debt has become the anchor weighting them down, making it harder to start a family, buy a home, and live with financial independence. Over 43 million Americans hold more than $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. Roughly 1 in 5 borrowers are in default, and the challenges are even worse for students of color. This is unsustainable. And with Joe Biden in the White House, Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, the time is now to take action. In the American Rescue Plan, I pushed for tens of billions of dollars in financial relief for struggling universities, making sure at least half of the funding went to help students' financial aid. We also made student loan forgiveness between now and December 2025 tax-free so that we don't give with one hand while taking away with the other. But most importantly, I have joined with Senator Elizabeth Warren and other Democrats in calling on President Biden to cancel up to $50,000 in student loans for each student. This would make an enormous difference in the fight against income inequality and in the march towards greater racial equity. It would benefit those who need help most, A recent study by the Roosevelt Institute showed that the largest share of debt cancellation dollars from our plan would go to families with the least wealth. The study also found that through our proposal, Black and Latino borrowers in the bottom 10% of wealth would receive over 30 and 20 times more debt cancellation than borrowers in the top 10%. That means a new life for millions upon millions of students, particularly low-income and diverse student loan borrowers, crushed by the weight of the debt. With the flick of a pen, President Biden could get it done, and I promise that I'll keep pushing the Biden administration to do it. We have lots of work to do, but I'm confident that by working together, better days lie ahead. Thank you all so much, and see you soon.
Thank you, Senator Schumer. You know, researchers and policymakers alike share a common goal of solving stubborn societal problems, including student debt. Because of the increased need for post-secondary degree attainment to participate in a knowledge-based economy, students are compelled to saddle themselves with more loans to attend college. Today, student debt is a larger source of household indebtedness than credit cards and automobiles, surpassed only by home mortgages. From 1993 to 2012, the share of students taking out loans to finance the degrees rose roughly half to over two-thirds. Between 1993 and 2020, the average loan amount grew nearly threefold, surpassing $30,000. This wouldn't be as much of a problem if borrowers' incomes increased comparably. But alas, the upsurge in tuition has outpaced the rise in wages and overall inflation. While most analysts across the political spectrum believe we have a student debt problem, there is variation about how to deal with it. Much of the debate revolves around how much student loan debt should be discharged. However, it's the who in policy that determines many budgetary considerations. Understanding the impact of student debt on specific groups can shed light on the question of how much. But we've struggled as a nation to appropriately determine the who in public policy and research. One of the most consequential manifestations of that struggle is the Black-white wealth divide. Generations of anti-Black exclusive policy, often supported by research, contributed to white families realizing 10 times the amount of wealth of Black families. Not only did federal, state, and local legislators intentionally throttle Black wealth with malicious policies such as slavery, Jim Crow racism, biased housing, and criminal justice practices, they excluded Black Americans from reaping the full benefits of the New Deal, which lifted many more white families out of poverty, enabling more white households to pass on intergenerational wealth. Our solutions for the student debt problem should not repeat this sordid history. In fact, past discrimination should have us check potential policies' impacts on historically disenfranchised groups. Yet one of the most repeated mistakes in the student debt cancellation debates is the assumption that all people within particular income strata have the same ability to pay back their loans, masking the lived experiences of Black people. Colorblind income-based analyses miss the mark. Most student debt is held by households with zero to negative net worth. I'm going to share my screen here, and hopefully you can see this chart that shows that most households most student debt is held by households with zero or to negative net worth. Ignoring the racial wealth divide is to bury one's head in the sand to racial injustice. This is where many regressivity arguments that hold debt cancellation is an idea that will primarily benefit the rich fall flat. Over the last quarter century, Black people are going to college at higher rates, but we are taking on more debt than our peers, throttling our capacity to purchase homes and start businesses. In a recent Brookings Jane Family Institute research brief titled Student Loans, the Racial Wealth Divide, and Why We Need Full Student Debt Cancellation. We'll make sure to get that on Twitter. Jane Family Institute fellow, senior fellow, Marshall Steinbaum, research assistant Carl Romer, who you both meet today, and I show how Black people take out higher amounts of student loans than every other racial group. I'm going to get to that. And you can see that blue line representing Black borrowers there exceeding the amount of other groups. This chart reveals Black people striving. We're going to college more, but it also reveals our lack of wealth and the need for financial aid. The impact of discrimination on wealth can also be seen in the share of loans, where debtors' current balances exceed the original amounts. Again, I'm going to show another chart that shows where balances are starting to exceed the original amount. Again, blue representing Black borrowers. Okay. Not only are individuals saddled with debt, entire neighborhoods are as well. Our report also shows student debt as a share of income is highest and growing fastest in the lowest income areas. Let me click on that slide. You can see here in the census tract, this is where most outstanding balances lie. The claim that student debt cancellation is regressive tends to be followed by pointing out that a large number of borrowers have the same amount of debt, and a relatively small number of borrowers carry a large proportion of the total debt burden. That much is true, but the unstated implication is that the low number of high balance borrowers that would benefit the most from canceling outstanding balances tend to have higher incomes. That implication is false. Oops. Sorry about that. The plurality of outstanding debt is held by borrowers with the highest balances who live in census tracts in which the median income is between $20,000 and $40,000. Oh, I'm sorry. I went past the slide. I apologize for that. Meanwhile, the high income census tracts account for a very low number of borrowers, suggesting that better off people are less likely to have student debt. Other studies have reported that differences in interest accrual and graduate school borrowing lead to Black graduates holding about twice as much student debt, about 53,000, as our white counterparts four years after graduation. Given the racial wealth disparities and debt to income ratio, it's not surprising that an estimated 7.6% of Black graduates default on loans within 4 years of graduation, compared to 2.4% of white graduates. Without question, we have a student debt problem. However, real solutions can be found when Black lives are recognized in policy and research. In the Brookings report titled Student Debt Cancellation Should Consider Wealth, Not Income, Carl Romer and I find that when all student debt is canceled, the numerical difference between the wealth of non-Black and Black households shrinks significantly for households between the second and 20th percentiles. Likewise, we find the more debt is canceled, the greater the racial wealth gap is reduced at every wealth percentile. Now I'll go back to that chart that I wanted to show you before. Likewise, now those when we reduce that debt, those are the kinds of solutions that we're all in need of. Today, we're going to explore more of this topic. However, we will not replicate the mistakes of the past. We will center the lived experiences of Black borrowers to guide our discussion. And we will do this first by showing an interview between Carl Romer of Brookings and Braxton Simpson of Rise. So let's go to that interview. Oh.
Thank you, Andre, and thank you all for joining our event, Examining the Effects of Student Debt Cancellation. My name is Carl Romer, and I am a co-author on the reports that you just heard Andre talking about. Today, I am joined by Braxton Simpson, the HBCU Fellow with RISE. Braxton, if you could tell us a little bit about RISE, your role relating to education and student debt, and what drew you to this organization.
Absolutely. RISE, first of all, just thank you for allowing me to be here today. RISE is a student-led nonprofit that is basically representing more than 80,000 diverse youth voters all across the country, advocating for college affordability. And what ultimately drew me to RISE was just their pure dedication for just wanting to help students that no one ever considers, right? The student from a marginalized community, the student without funds to attend college, the student who just needs to tap into civic engagement the most because it directly impacts their lives and their reality. So, just students like myself, I found a lot of myself in who I am and where I come from inside of this organization, RISE, and their devotion just to progressing, advocating for students who are sometimes forgotten, I think is what drew me to the organization the most. Personally, I serve as an HBCU RISE Fellow, in which, you know, my sole mission is ultimately to advocate on behalf of college affordability. And I've been advocating for college affordability for HBCU students and ensuring that HBCUs are always a part of the conversation when it comes to college affordability. We're speaking about the effects of student loan debt on students, HBCUs. We're populated with Black students all across the globe. Students come from low income, low access neighborhoods and backgrounds. And it's imperative that we are never forgotten when we're talking about conversations around educational attainment and access.
That's awesome, Braxton. Thank you for that answer. There's a lot of different directions that I want to go with that. But I think that the first thing that I'd like to ask you about is, when you talk about the forgotten students, one of the things that's being talked about right now is that for lower income students or for lower income graduates, after they graduate, they're able to use income-driven repayment and have kind of low payments on their student loan balances. Over the past year, we've seen, actually, as the moratorium on student debt repayment has been enacted, that no one has been paying their student debt payments. But can you talk about how, even without paying back high amounts, those forgotten students, the HBCU graduates, still have high balance loans, and those balances still affect them, even without payments?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I'll just pretty much leave it at, you know, when we're talking about HBCUs, you know, HBCUs were founded for students a long time ago that just didn't have access just to an education, and it provided that opportunity for them. And we're talking, you know, these are descendants directly generation removed from slavery, right? And so, of course, these individuals were low income and low access. And so HBCUs have been working to still live out that same mission in helping students that come from low income and low access backgrounds and being able to afford college. So a lot of HBCU students do accumulate a lot of debt because, you know, over 90% of HBCU students have to use federal dollars in order to, attend school and to be able to pursue an education. And so even though, you know, there has kind of been this halt, HBCU students and HBCU graduates will still be directly impacted by the amount of debt that is accumulated just from wanting to attend school.
That's a really shocking statistic that I hadn't heard before, that 90% of HBCU graduates need to take out federal dollars in order to attend school. As an HBCU graduate myself, I know that that was true of me and my friends, but I didn't realize how pervasive that is in the HBCU world. And so speaking of which, you graduated from Tennessee State University, and Tennessee State University was recently in the news for Tennessee's underfunding of the institution. And so this type of devaluation and underfunding of HBCUs is chronic and widespread. Can you talk a little bit about how educational underfunding and graduate outcomes are related?
Of course. Absolutely. You know, yes, I am a proud alumna of the illustrious Tennessee State University in Nashville, Tennessee, just graduated. And that institution supports so much to me. You know, our story is like the story of many HBCUs all across the country that have been historically devalued and underfunded for decades on end, right? Educational underfunding and graduate outcomes are directly correlated. You know, the truth of the matter is HBCUs, we've had to make lemonade without lemons to begin with. And we've had to, you know, we've taken the scraps and we've still been able to produce, you know, excellence. You know, as far as it comes with Tennessee State University, you know, we are a land-grant institution, an 1890 land-grant institution, which means that we receive a mass majority of our funding from the government that is aligned with our agricultural status. And just as, you know, our neighboring institution, the University of Tennessee Knoxville, another public institution in Tennessee. And, you know, for years, Tennessee State University was supposed to be receiving a match from the Tennessee State government, in which they provided both TSU and UTK a match of 1-to-1. And unfortunately, for years, UTK has received up to 6 times their match on some years from the government to support their student body, while TSU has failed to receive their 1-to-1 match. So in some years, TSU's match actually was allocated to the University of Tennessee Knoxville. And so the failure of the Tennessee State government to place HBCU education at the forefront and to value its contribution to the country has, you know, in the community at large, and the community at large has, you know, forced HBCUs everywhere, honestly, to have to dip into operational funds that could aid in newer facilities, that could make ends meet, to just to keep the lights on and ultimately provide scholarships that would keep students in school. And so when there is a lack of funding, specifically at an HBCU, students are less likely to matriculate as their focus isn't solely on their education. They now have to shift their focus and focus on other things to fund their education, like working and dealing with their living conditions as a result of the lack of governmental funding that's allocated to the school. And, you know, what's sad is, you know, for years, the blame has been passed down from society onto historically Black colleges and universities as being, you know, ineffective or not managing their funds properly. But in all actuality, much of this should be directed toward the state governments due to their failure to place an emphasis on supporting HBCUs and HBCU students.
Wow. I think that gets right at my next question, which is going to be about what, when we imagine the future, what does that look like? HBCUs currently are only 3% of college students, but they produce 20% of Black college graduates. And so how do you think about when we think about canceling student debt for the future or making tuition-free college, how does that change the economic opportunity for HBCU students?
It changes it, Carl. It changes immensely. You know, for so long, HBCUs have essentially, like I said, that we've been asked to make lemonade without lemons to begin with. And, you know, we've had to do a lot with a little, and we've done that. We've produced the most Black professionals in STEM, medicine, dentistry, law, every field, you name it. And the mere fact that HBCUs produce the best and the brightest, yet only represent 3% of college students. This administration can make a commitment to ensuring that 3% is uplifted, empowered, and supported. It is imperative, you know, to keep in mind that HBCUs were birthed out of oppression. Being the only Blacks, the only place that Blacks could turn for an education. You know, HBCUs were started to provide the sons and daughters of slaves the opportunity to an education, regardless of their income and their access to education. You know, and like I said earlier, HBCUs were actively working at continuing that legacy to ensure the success and, you know, giving our Black students a chance at success and economic attainment, regardless of background and where they come from. You know, HBCUs produce, they produce well, and an investment in HBCU is an investment in your communities and in this country. So when we talk about reparations, when we talk about closing the racial wealth gap, when we talk about equity, we can start with access to education and college affordability for HBCUs and their students. By eliminating student loan debt and making college free, you know, HBCU students won't have to focus all of their energy on paying for school, but instead can shift the focus directly on school. Graduates can focus, you know, on building generational wealth that will aid in strengthening the Black family instead of having to shift their focus on paying off loans. It's imperative, you know, that the Biden administration fulfills his promise of college affordability while ensuring that HBCUs remain at the center of this broader conversation.
That's a bright future that you just laid out, and I really hope that we can achieve that in the very near future. So is there anything else that people ought to know about HBCUs, HBCU graduates, canceling debt, free college, anything along those lines?
Sure. You know, Carl, I'll leave you with this. And this is something that I always say. You know, when we can keep the most marginalized people at the center of our service, everyone that falls outside will reap the benefits of that. So if we make a conscious effort to keep HBCU college affordability and funding at the center of our service, communities, institutions, structures that lie on the outside will be better because of it. So we have to invest in HBCUs, invest in college affordability, and make college free.
Braxton Simpson, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm going to turn it over to Andre now, who is going to moderate a discussion between three phenomenal scholars, panelists, and I hope that you enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. At this time, I'm going to bring in our panelists. We have Beth Akers of AEI, Braxton Brewington of the Debt Collective, and Marshall Steinbaum of the Jane Family Institute and the University of Utah. Thanks for presenting today. And I'm gonna get right into it. I wanna just hear how you all characterize this problem and if you see it as a problem. And I'm gonna actually start with Beth. Please give us your overall general thoughts of the nature of the problem and the nature of debt cancellation as a solution.
Well, I think I'm sometimes mischaracterized as the student loan crisis denier. So I will be very clear that that's not the position I'm taking today or in general. I think that part of what we've seen is a huge run up in student loan debt. And part of that is a great thing because it reflects huge investments in education that we know on average historically have paid huge dividends in terms of earnings opportunities. And so when we look a bit closer than that, we of course see that there are problems with student lending that need fixing. The issues of the racial wealth gap, of course, separate from the issue of student loan debt, are an important problem to our economy and our society. Even then, within the student loan system, there are places that I think are in need of desperate reform. For example, the safety net that exists to support borrowers to prevent the sort of hardship that we have been talking about so far today that many borrowers are experiencing. So what I see is a trend that is in part positive and in part concerning because of the portions of the system that is not working well. So I'm in favor of nuanced solutions that address those specific problems rather than something that looks like a widespread student loan cancellation program.
So I just want to be clear. So we're untangling some of the other systemic problems from the larger or systemic or from student debt as a problem.
That's right. I tend to see that this conversation is combining some of the more systemic problems in our economy. Welcome to my dog for joining the panel today. I'm concerned that we're using student debt as a mechanism to solve some of the deeper issues that we face, particularly the racial wealth gap, when they might be better or more efficiently addressed through other more direct policy interventions.
I'm going to turn it over to Braxton to answer the same question. You know, describe or characterize the nature of the problem, and is debt cancellation an appropriate solution?
Yeah, I think so often we talk about student debt as this thing that we're just looking at based off of data. And I want to really talk about the experiences of borrowers, in part because of Joe Biden's decades-long assault on borrower protections, and other Republicans and Democrats who have really worked in tandem to strip borrower protections, some of the things that I think, Beth, you agree we should improve. Student debtors are not this old image that we have of affluent white doctors, right, who have these large sums of debt and they're rich. And if we cancel that debt, it'll just give them more money. Student debtors are not being able to start families. They're not being able to buy homes. Folks are living in their cars. People are really, especially Black households, the precarity of Black households, I think in particular, we see that people have zero net wealth. They have negative net wealth. And so, you know, we have debtors' prisons were, I think, outlawed over 100 years ago, but people are indeed at risk of incarceration. They're being incarcerated because they can't afford to pay their student loan debt. So when we talk about this crisis, I think it's important to center real experiences. And, you know, myself in particular, I'm glad that Braxton Simpson talked about the HBCU experience. I'm one of those 90%+ of HBCU students that had to borrow federal dollars, because how else would we afford to go to college when you've been stripped of generational wealth, when you've been stripped of wealth building opportunities? And, you know, there's a saying that when white folks catch a cold, Black folks get pneumonia. I think in a lot of respects, that's exactly what we're seeing with the student debt crisis, that we are all suffering, but we're not all suffering equally. And we need cancellation, not just because it will narrow the racial wealth gap, not just because it will advance gender justice or boost the economy, but because education should be free. It should be free, and it should be freeing, right? We should be encouraging folks to have a liberatory experience in higher education and treat higher education as it used to be, which is a public good.
Marshall.
Thanks for having me on this panel. And I want to thank my predecessors for really stating the case better than I could have. I thought especially that Braxton Simpson's narrative of the defunding or underfunding of Tennessee State and the resulting prevalence of student debt among graduates of HBCUs is very telling. I think that really defeats the whole narrative that student debt cancellation is regressive, as Braxton Brewington just alluded to. I mean, this crisis arises from deep inequities in the way that education is provided, in the way that generational wealth is handed down. And that is what gives rise to the student debt crisis. I thought Beth just said something that for once I agreed with, which was that we're using student debt to address other systemic issues. And I think that is absolutely right. We're basically saying, you know, a whole generations of people that have been disempowered and disinherited should essentially take on debt to overcome those institutional inequities, and then turning around and confronting the reality of, okay, now there's deep inequities and who has debt and who has what amount of debt. You know, that's somehow the borrower's fault for making the wrong decisions or attending the wrong school or majoring in the wrong subject. And I think it's really, you know, not just wrong, as I've tried to show in my empirical research, but offensive, frankly, to make that claim against the evidence as it is and as we know it is. I just want to say sort of what my three causes of what I think, you know, we have to confront in understanding how the student debt crisis arises, kind of beyond just the questions of who has debt and who has what amount. We've had the institutional underfunding that Braxton Simpson referred to, and in general, the public higher education system has been defunded. in such a way that institutions that are minority serving have suffered the worst. We've tried to have, at the same time as that, more and more people go to college and get higher degrees in order to get a job. And that means more people means more diverse people going to college, people who are less able to rely on their families to support themselves than previous generations. And then finally, we have institutional segregation, which means that generally the least well-off students and coming from disadvantaged backgrounds are going to the least resourced institutions that are thus the most reliant on tuition and thus on their graduates taking on debt. So it's really the failure of a, you know, to use the buzzword of the day, neoliberalized higher education system, in particular in serving minorities. I just want to close with one point, which is the other day I was on a panel with Sandy Baum, and she criticized the literature that Braxton referred to that shows student debt reducing home ownership and reducing entrepreneurship and other elements of the pathologies of the economic life cycle being undermined by accumulating student debt early in life, and basically said, well, you know, of course, not having debt is worse than having debt, but not having education is worse than all of that. And that's a really a false choice, because we have had a public higher education system that provides education funded collectively, not individually. And basically what happened was we privatized that at the same time it was diversified, and thus made it a much more extractive system than it is a contributing system to individual wealth. So we can have education without having student debt. In fact, we know that in the past. The question is just how democratic it should be and how inclusive it should be.
Now, I want to get right to Senator Schumer's remarks around the $50,000. I know, Beth, that you've argued that we should cancel a little debt. Can you explain what the right amount is? And because it seems like $10,000, which Biden is promoting, $50,000, which Senator Warren and Schumer promote, they seem kind of arbitrary numbers. You know, what's our target on this, and why, and what amount is appropriate for you?
Well, I'll tell you, my goal is to support the people who are the most economically vulnerable. I think that intersects a lot with what my opponents here are arguing today, which is that racial minorities are having worse outcomes on average than white, more well-off students. And so what I'd like to see is that instead of a one-size-fits-all handout, we have a more nuanced solution that crafts the size of the relief to the need of the individual. And so that happens through a program like income-driven repayment that is our existing but really ineffective safety net for borrowers. So when I've proposed $5,000, it has as a level of student loan cancellation, it has a couple reasons why. First, we see that a lot of the people who are defaulting on student loans have these really small balances. A lot of them have started college but not finished a degree, so they haven't gotten that earnings bump that would make their student loan repayment affordable. So that gets rid of those. But the more primary reason for it is that I offered it as a bargaining chip, because I think what really needs to happen is that we need to reinvent the safety net that ensures that borrowers do not face unaffordable monthly payments based on how much they're earning, and that borrowers who do not see a prospect of earning enough to be able to effectively or affordably repay their loans will have their loans forgiven. So that takes a huge overhaul of the existing program to get there. I think offering $5,000 as cancellation kind of says, okay, let's put a pause on what's happening, give Congress time to craft that solution, and then put it into place. But the $5,000 was not the right number. I think there is no single right number for everyone. It's more to say, let's buy ourselves some time so that we can craft a more nuanced, need-based, targeted solution.
Now, Braxton, you've written that $10,000 is certainly not enough. Why isn't it enough? And I'll ask you the same question. What is the right amount in this debate?
Yeah, I think $10,000 is laughable. And I think, you know, I want to first mention, you know, the president has the ability to unilaterally cancel every single penny worth of student debt. And that's exactly the exact amount that's enough, which is every single penny, because college shouldn't be costing anything anyways. You know, $10,000, I think was, I'm going to be clear, President Biden ran on a minimum of $10,000 for every single borrower. And then he actually promised more for people who go to HBCUs or people who graduate from public colleges and universities. I think what's amazing here in that promise is that that's coming from, again, the person who has crafted such an assault on borrower protections, right? That if we had actually, you know, this is some of the most conservative of the Democratic presidential candidates that proposed such a sweeping form of cancellation, right? And so if someone with his history of assaulting borrower protections is proposing a minimum of 10K, what do we actually really deserve here? So full cancellation is absolutely what we need. And that can be done, as Chuck Schumer said, with the flick of a pen. But these numbers are very arbitrary. Even the 50K number that Warren and Schumer are pushing is from old data. Those folks are now saying 75K, right? So after the pandemic, what does that number look like now? Is it then 100K? I think we start to play a game and we make this false equivalency, like $1 worth of cancellation is then $1 that comes from the taxpayer, when we know that that's not true. Cancellation, mass cancellation, would be an economic stimulus to everyone, whether you have student debt or not. And I think that's why we're seeing cities across the country, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Boston, pass these resolutions calling on President Biden to cancel student debt, because they know that, especially after, you know, not after, during this pandemic, that people, you know, are need to invest in local economy, and they can do that if they have more cash in their pocket. And what better way to do that than to cancel student debt?
Now, Marshall, I'm going to switch it up a little bit, because Beth teed up something that is a factor in this debate, is income-based repayment systems. Can you explain what they are and what's problematic about them, considering wealth and income as very different factors?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. So in some sense, what is income-driven repayment? There's basically a couple of different federal programs that cap payments, monthly payments on student debt, to be a given percentage of an individual's, quote, disposable income. And the idea is that that adjusts down payments for people who don't earn enough to make payments and are at high risk of defaulting on those payments in any case. So essentially, forms of income-driven repayment have existed for decades, but they've become much more prevalent in terms of the share of the debtor population that's making use of them in the last couple of years. And basically what happened was, in the Great Recession, we had an increase in the amount of debt people were taking on, and especially in the types of different types of people taking on debt and not getting the earnings bump that's supposed to go with it. So this is, Beth referred to the fact of non-completion causing people not to experience an earnings bump. But the fact is, nobody has. You know, this idea that taking on debt automatically leads to higher earnings, or does if you at least complete the university, just is not true. That's the fundamental cause and harm of the student debt crisis, is the basic economic assumption that people who would take on debt would automatically essentially finance its repayment. So IDR basically says, okay, we have all these people who are defaulting because they aren't in an earnings position to pay off their debt. Instead of continuing to experience this wave of defaults, why don't we just adjust down payments? And so people don't have as large an obligation, therefore much less likely to default. The effect of that, under the system that we already have of individual level student loan balances that's attached to your name, even if you are successfully enrolled in IDR, which is not so easy. So in fact, the beneficiary population is quite different from what it appears to be on paper. That's an important point that we should remember when pointing to IDR as an alternative to student debt cancellation. What it means when people are enrolled in IDR is, instead of making monthly payments, their balance just accumulates. And that, I think, gets to the issue, Andre, that you brought up about the difference between income versus wealth. If your balance on student debt is accumulating, that means your net worth position is deteriorating. And that's especially harmful if you start out from a low or negative net worth position. And that's the economic life cycle concerns that lead to these issues of being unable to buy your own home, entrepreneurship, not being able to start a family, being tied to particular jobs. All of those knock-on effects of carrying around this large burden are the result of thinking that, you know, basically the problem of student debt is just the problem of present monthly payments being too high given present monthly income, and not taking into account the overall picture of net worth, especially its racial dimensions.
Can I jump back in there?
Yep, go for it.
So I want to concede a point for the sake of finding some compromise here and say, you know, I think you're right to say that looking at who benefits from student loan cancellation by income, it does not tell the whole story. And I'll say, you know, when student loan cancellation kind of came on the scene, can't remember how long it was ago now, I was one of the first to go out there and say, look, this is actually regressive. We've got a lot of very high income people getting this benefit. My rationale for saying that was I didn't think that people appreciated that there were, in fact, a lot of high earners who were in a very strong economic position because their degree had paid off, who would benefit from student loan cancellation. So recently we have this pivot in the discussion talking about, no, in fact, student loan cancellation is not regressive. It's progressive if you look at wealth. Now, here's where I get to push back and say, I don't think wealth tells the whole story either. So we often see economically people choosing to go into a negative wealth situation because it enhances their wealth in the long run. So when someone takes on a mortgage, they reduce their wealth dramatically, right? Because your wealth is just the sum of your assets and your debt. But we celebrate people taking on mortgages because we know historically, or we've believed historically, that taking on that debt actually increases your lifetime wealth. All of the economic research we have to date suggests that the same is true on average for people borrowing to invest in their human capital, borrowing student debt to invest in their future career. So I really believe that we're not doing ourselves any favor by using these labels, by trying to use a single metric to show that student loan cancellation is good or bad. My feeling is that we should be talking about economic vulnerability. Student loan cancellation or student loan debt absolutely plays a role in economic vulnerability, but student loans themselves are not a fantastic indicator of economic vulnerability. So we need to get a little bit savvier. I'll throw out another one I think I can get Marshall and maybe Braxton to agree with me on, and that's we need reform of the prohibition on discharge of student loans in bankruptcy. So that goes back to what I just said, which is that these single metrics, wealth, income, don't tell the whole story about an individual's economic vulnerability. So we need to get a little bit savvier in thinking about that, but that calls for a nuanced solution, not just a wipe away all of student debt.
Braxton, before you get in here, I just want to just clarify, but isn't student debt a much different type of debt than mortgages? I mean, one is literally going to the building of assets that drive wealth, and others uncollateralized debt that is problematic, right?
Well, I tend to believe that when people spend on education, that they are investing in their quote unquote human capital. They're investing in their future earnings potential. Yes, it's less tangible. Yes, you can't sell your college degree once you've gotten it. So there are some fundamental differences, but there are some fundamental similarities in that it's a way of financing an investment that on average historically has paid off for individuals.
Braxton, you I know you want to weigh in on this.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that Marshall was talking about IDR that, check me if I'm wrong, only some like 32 individuals literally have successfully had their debt canceled using income-driven repayment. So this isn't like a conversation of like, well, it doesn't really work very well. Like, it clearly doesn't work. And so reforming that, I think, is gonna, you know, just kick the can down the road. I think what Beth and a lot of folks are grappling with is the reality that debt is a trap. The nature of debt is that it is a form of social control, and that this capitalist fable that we have been taught of upward mobility, right? We've been told, I took financial literacy classes in college, and we were told good debt. We were told there was good types of debt. And I think what people are grappling with is that really is not true, and that debt erodes our freedom, and it really puts us in a form, especially again for Black households, Black and brown households especially have to, succumb to these predatory natures where people are coming to people's homes, getting all types of phone calls. And so I think what we're grappling with really is the predatory nature of debt. And I want to really push back on this idea that people should have to pay for public goods, just like healthcare. We're having that same conversation where education is a public good. So we really, that is the nuance there that I think we're talking about, that sweeping cancellation. We don't have to, abide by these sort of neoliberal rules of how to tweak things here and there, when really the solution is very simple. It's just broad scale cancellation.
Can I just insert this? a comparable situation is how we fund K-12 education. I mean, in general, we consider it basic that the returns on investment are well worth it. We don't ask families to pay back a grant, so to speak, for if they drop out of high school or they drop out of elementary school. It's subsidized moving forward. Beth, would you agree with that sort of analogy? And moving forward, should post-secondary education be subsidized in a similar way, not necessarily through the states, but should it be subsidized?
So I'll concede that's the harder argument to push back against, which is that we have sort of an arbitrary system of quote unquote socialized education that ends at grade 12, right? And then we move to a market-based system. So is that the exact precise moment at which we should be shifting from a socialized to a market-based system? It's really hard to make that argument. But on one hand, I think that's separate from the issue at hand today, because yeah. I want to talk about when we have student loan cancellation, I'm super concerned, of course, about the distribution of benefits, who's winning and who's losing from this. But I'm also concerned about what happens to the system going forward, absent a reform of the type that you're talking about. So, you know, I just wrote a book where I talked about to people about how to think like an economist when they shop for college. And I can guarantee you that if I were to write a new book next year, I'd be advising people to take on a lot more debt than they were this year. And that's because of the likelihood that they're going to see another loan cancellation jubilee in the future. So as we take away the incentive for people to be savvy shoppers and to borrow wisely, we only are going to balloon the problem of borrowing. And even if we pass the free college program that Biden has proposed, which is free community college, we don't eliminate student debt in doing that. So the problem doesn't go away. So I'm super concerned about what happens to our incentives for borrowing. And are we just going to be having this conversation 2 or 3 years from now, but with a balance in student debt that's growing at an even faster clip?
We have a related question that I want to pull into the conversation. This comes from Benjamin Reap. If widespread debt forgiveness or bankruptcy protection expansion is necessary, what changes would you make to the federal lending programs moving forward to protect taxpayers from continual student loan bailouts? You want to pick up on that, Beth, because you kind of teed that up.
Yeah. Something I'm concerned about is that we continually, year after year, make lots of loans that, statistically speaking, we don't expect to be affordable for someone to pay back. And when that's the case, we're necessarily just passing on the cost to taxpayers. So I'm fine with putting costs for education onto taxpayers, but I'd much prefer we do it transparently and on the front end. So if we want someone to go for an education that is not going to pay sufficient dividends for them to pay it back with borrowing, then we need to pass legislation that puts grants into place to make that happen. And I'd like to see a bit more underwriting in the federal student loan program. The biggest place or the low-hanging fruit here is in the grad program, the PLUS program. People are borrowing with very little limitations on what they're able to take on. And that is often getting passed directly back onto taxpayers because of the current structure of income-driven repayment. So I think that's the first place I would probably scale back on borrowing eligibility.
Marshall, you want to chime in here?
Yes, I think this is a very important point. So I definitely agree with the basic political sentiment that I feel being expressed both by the question and by Beth, which is that if we're canceling a ton of student debt now, lots of loans that are being originated now basically have no expectation of being repaid, which I agree with. You know, that's obviously a problem, and that's a problem for which canceling outstanding debt is not a sufficient solution. I think the political effect of doing that would be to highlight the problem, which I view as a positive upside, and you know, the federal taxpayer would be rightfully questioning, you know, am I just going to have to write another check basically in 5 years, or I should say forswear receiving future revenue again in 5 years as a result of, you know, the fact that the higher education system doesn't work, because it's true that it doesn't work. You know, we have to be talking about tuition regulation. That's what the phrase free college basically refers to. It comes with federal money. In general, the institutions don't like it because the business model that they run is one in which they're charging high tuition to basically the students that they perceive as being willing to pay that tuition. Now, the fact is, you know, its willingness to pay underappreciates the necessity that a lot of people have towards credentializing themselves in order to qualify for the labor market. So it's basically a system that requires the least advantaged people to pay more into it in order to give themselves the degrees that they need. That's the model that the higher education institutions have come to depend upon. And I don't think that's a very good model. And I really fear the type of what Beth is referring to by underwriting federal student loans is basically having the federal government as lender be more discriminating as to who should be qualified to take them out and as for which program, and picking and choosing the programs that are offered by institutions such that they may not be eligible for federal lending. And I think that that's actually like going in the worst possible direction, because it's saying that access to this higher education system, which is already institutionally segregated, you should have more of the elements of the private mortgage market, the private credit market in general, which is to say underwriters being more discerning in the sense of who's likeliest to be able to repay it. And we know what it means in the private market, in the private credit market, you know, who ends up paying the highest rates, who ends up getting being denied for loans. So that would only worsen issues of institutional segregation. I am in sympathy with the idea that we need to do something to stop the federal government from basically pumping. I mean, what I view the accumulated stock of student debt as is the deficit in state funding of higher education that has been made up by institutions transitioning their business models to be dependent on tuition, and the human capital returns to higher education that Beth keeps referring to keep not materializing. So instead of being paid off, those balances just accumulate over time. And this is the money that states have not invested in higher education. So I think, you know, the federal government needs to shift the burden of paying for higher education off of individual student shoulders, but not in a way that basically denies access to higher education to a broad swath of the population. It's basically a sort of raise the drawbridge reaction to the student debt crisis, which I think is terribly inequitable and would lead the wrong direction for policy. Instead, we should go to what Andre was referring to, which is the more public goods oriented version of higher education that is represented by our K-12 system to the extent that it is.
Yeah, Braxton, this is an issue I often hear about and read about, is that critics will say that student debt cancellation is a solution for a different problem, and that ultimately that the cost, the inefficiencies in higher education administration are just being passed down to low wealth folks. How do you respond to those criticisms or folks who say, let's put more of a focus on reforming higher education financing or the lack thereof versus debt cancellation?
Yeah, I don't think that student debt cancellation is being proposed as the solution to fix higher education. It's a crisis all on its own, right? So we have people who are, you know, in a state of precarity, like we talked about, and that's why they need cancellation. Yes, though we should also fix higher education. Just a quick comparison, we should cancel medical debt because people shouldn't be in medical debt. But the response to that is, well, we should just fix our healthcare system as a whole. Well, yes, obviously, but it would be a really cheap and quick solution to cancel medical debt so people aren't suffering with bills because they got sick or something. So, you know, it's canceling student debt is not the solution to reforming higher education. Although I think it brings us on that pathway to get, you know, some type of legislation passed through Congress, which seems difficult. So I think it's, you know, that's why we should be pushing the president to use whatever tool he has at his disposal as fast as he can, which is cancellation.
Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about equity in a different sense. For wealthy folk, we have lots of programs and initiatives that enable families to get some savings for higher education. We typically don't talk about the benefits to the wealthy. Beth, can you address public policy in terms of the benefits that we've given to wealthy folks and how that enters this debate?
Yeah, so I'd love to take all higher education benefits out of the tax code, to be honest with you, because of exactly what you just implied, which is that they disproportionately benefit people who are of higher income, more financially savvy. So I, for example, can take advantage of tax advantage on a 529 savings plan for my son, which I'm doing. I'm able to do that because I have the excess income to set aside to save for his education. I would much prefer we take those benefits away from people like me who, to be frank, don't need them and plug it into Pell Grants, because Pell Grants are transparent. It's much more likely that somebody who is unsure if they can afford college or not will take into account the value of a grant through a Pell Grant rather than thinking, okay, now if I file my taxes, do I get a tax credit next year for that will help offset the cost or not? I mean, that's crazy thinking. That's not how household budgets work, especially not for low-income individuals. So I think it's absolutely a fair criticism. It's on par with the mortgage interest deduction in terms of being just inappropriate and politically motivated.
Marshall or Braxton, you want to weigh in on that? Or that good? Because we actually have a lot of questions coming in. Again, you can tweet at student debt using the hashtag student debt at Brookings Metro, or you can email events at brookings.edu. We have a quick, very specific program, but it's coming in a lot. What about Parent PLUS loans? If and how those might be included in any forgiveness cancellation plan? Marshall, I'll have you take that on that one.
Yes. So my understanding is that as long as Parent PLUS loans have not been refinanced out of the federal system, they are eligible for cancellation. Certainly, legally, that's the case. And so the question kind of comes down to, well, what actual proposal is on the table, and nothing to reduce or take Parent PLUS loans out of the equation has been mooted to my knowledge. This is a very important point to emphasize, because the federal policy encourages parents and other family members to take on debt to finance the education of their children. And I think especially a lot of Black families take advantage of this, not just Black families, obviously, in that, you know, it's considered sort of societally expected that parents will contribute to the education of their children. And yet we know there's these huge racial wealth gaps. So what that means for Black families is parents taking out debt. That kind of undermines, I mean, it's one of many things that undermines this vision of the student loan system as students investing in their future earnings, and in particular, you know, traditional students going to college directly after high school full time until that, you know, then completing a degree and entering the labor market. That whole narrative underappreciates the diversity of experience with the higher education system, including, parents essentially making up for their inability to contribute to their children's education from their wealth by taking out PLUS loans. And so it's certainly appropriate that they be included in a cancellation proposal.
Anybody have anything else to add to that? We have a lot of questions around public service loan forgiveness. And I'll just share one. There's several. What are the chances of forgiveness to public service workers through PSLF, public service loan forgiveness? Couldn't an option be that PSLF would allow anyone working in public service for 10 years to be forgiven without the curse of the paperwork process? But and by and large, can you just talk about the idea of forgiving loans based on public service? We'll go to Braxton, Beth, then Marshall.
I mean, quickly, I think we're getting into, again, we're starting to whittle down to picking and choosing who is deserving of higher education being free and who should be forced to pay for it. What we know is public service loan forgiveness also doesn't work, just like income-driven repayment. So the debt collective, I can't tell you how many messages we get of people who said, I was 7 years into it and turns out I really wasn't, or I thought I qualified for it and I'd been paying for a decade and it turns out I wasn't. We start to get in this game of reform and reformist reforms. And, I also don't want to be the person to pick and choose, you know, what you know, whether we deem a social worker as more valuable than a teacher or and all of these other professions, when we know public education is this is for the good of society. So I'll say that.
Beth?
I absolutely hate public service loan forgiveness program, and it's not for the reason you think. I'm fine with giving people my money. But what I hate is that we're now using the student loan system to solve a problem that's completely unrelated. So if we believe socially that people in private, in public service and nonprofits are undercompensated, and we wish to spend federal tax dollars to supplement the value of their compensation, why on earth would we ever do it through this convoluted system, which only benefits people who have student loan debt that requires them to make payments for 10 years to be in the program? Just pay them more, right? Let's create a tax credit for people who are in public service or who are in nonprofit. So take all that money out of public service loan forgiveness and just pay people more. Even I might even get on board with spending more money if you could just get it away from this just terribly complex and awful mechanism that has a lot of problems.
Marshall?
Yeah, I trust an AEI scholar to follow up, pay them more with the proposal for an employer tax credit, which doesn't actually increase people's pay. Instead, it increases the benefit that's going to employers when they can actually reduce pay as a result of the dependence of the employer, of the employee on that relationship. So yes, absolutely. The problem with the problem with PSLF is overall that people who have student debt aren't being paid enough, not that, you know, not that, you know, that should necessarily be treated solely through the PSLF program, but the way to cause people to be paid more is to increase their bargaining power in the labor market, which involves reducing their student loan amounts, among many other things, not giving a tax credit to their employer. I think the PSLF program is kind of coming into focus right now because the term on which you have to repay to qualify is on paper, at least the lowest of all of the IDR programs. So it's the one that where you have a sensible beneficiaries kind of coming into existence earliest. And so we're seeing, as Braxton earlier referred to, the government declining applications or denying applications of like 98% of applicants. And that's because they think they've qualified, but in fact, they haven't qualified because they're not in the right income-driven repayment program before they apply for cancellation. So all of that is a bureaucratic nightmare. I think, you know, bureaucratic nightmares aren't just that, because they tell you the priorities of policymakers and the people in power. And I think what happened here is that a program was created in like 2006 that wasn't sort of understood to be as generous, or at least as implied to be as generous as it really was. So lots of people have essentially structured their whole lives, and institutions have, I would guess, I'm pretty sure, structured programs as well as tuition with the expectation that this program will eventually forgive the debt that's taken on to attend. And that's just not been the case. And so the government's kind of on this hook for an implied commitment that nobody anticipated as being as large in 2006 when the program was created. And I would just say that is true of the entire IDR edifice, which is a lot bigger than PSLF. So, you know, just because we're not at 20 years yet, doesn't mean that that IDR is okay. You know, and PSLF is just bureaucratic difficulties that need to be ironed out.
I want to push back and just say the effect of an individual tax credit on public service on wages and the capture for employers would be identical to student loan cancellation through PSLF.
No, I don't agree with that, because you're not dependent on the employer. I mean, getting the taxpayer, the tax credit turned up in wages means that, you know, the employer can deny you the ability to claim it. And, you know, I guess what you're implying is that an employer that is in a position of certifying you for PSLF, I'm not sure if that's the case in all cases, but you know, that's only going back, or the PSLF looks back 10 years towards public service, and EITC, just to take the example that I assume you're referring to, is on an ongoing basis. So it's like you're not as dependent on any one employer to claim the benefit of PSLF as you are on any one employer to claim the benefit of EITC.
Now, I want to get to this point of the reason why, at least I write on this topic, is that when you center Black people in an experience, it really gives you new insights on how to move forward with debt cancellation. I just want to come back to this point. You know, how should we factor in the racial wealth divide to these initiatives? I mean, are there considerations when it comes specifically to Black families in discharging some of this debt? And I'll have Braxton take that on.
I mean, I think Braxton Simpson's made it really clear. And the Biden administration, since this is the administration we're under, has also made very clear that they strive to advance racial justice. And Derek Johnson, the NAACP president, made it even clearer, can't advance racial justice without canceling student debt. So I think we're hearing a chorus of voices who I would say have a pretty strong moral authority on the issue of racial justice and narrowing and closing the racial wealth gap, that, you know, you can't divide, you can't separate racial wealth and this gap, as well as gender gaps and other types of gaps, from cancellation and, you know, from these broad sweeping policies. And as Braxton Simpson said, you know, we need to center the people who are the most marginalized, and actually everyone else around them will begin to reap those benefits as well. So I think you're right. We'd have to do that.
Something I'm concerned about is that, in fact, this conversation leaves out altogether the most economically vulnerable Black Americans. And those are those who have not had access or chosen to go into higher education altogether. So, you know, a transfer to Black Americans with student loan debt, of course, would have an impact on the distribution of wealth along racial lines in this country. But what happens to the rest of Black Americans who are left behind? It seems to me that a lot of these arguments are, in fact, arguments for reparations rather than arguments for student loan cancellation. And again, are we using the wrong mechanism for solving a deeper social problem?
Marshall, do you have anything to add there?
Yes, I just do want to take this opportunity to make the point that I think was sort of alluded to earlier in this conversation, but not made explicitly, which is that earlier in the debate over student debt cancellation, there was an idea in currency that canceling too much student debt worsens racial wealth inequality. And that's how we got to this place where we're arguing over forgiveness amounts, because the framing was essentially like, you can't go too far. You have to find the right amount such that you're reducing racial wealth inequality and not increasing it by canceling too much student debt, which I put very emphatically in air quotes. I think what the research has now shown, including Andre's and Carl's research, is that there is no too much student debt cancellation vis-a-vis the racial wealth gap. And that speaks to the point that Beth is making, which is that, you know, there's some Black households or any households that don't have student debt at all, and they're the worst off. It's certainly true that there are poor people that don't have student debt, but when we actually measure the effect of canceling student debt on the racial wealth gap, it reduces the more student debt you cancel. So that doesn't speak in favor of limiting cancellation. There are, of course, other policies that should be enacted in order to reduce racial inequality, but there's no sense in which canceling student debt somehow worsens racial wealth inequality on any dimension.
And I wanted to quickly just state that canceling student debt and closing this racial wealth gap is not about reparations. It's about higher education as a public good, and that student debt in and of itself is illegitimate. And so that's why we're fighting for cancellation, because higher education is and should be a public good, and was a public good for people like Joe Biden and other, you know, folks of that generation that could reap the benefits of higher education. And so really what we're asking for is parity, not reparations. That's a separate.
We only have a few minutes left, and I actually want us to close on this question that we received. What is the future of higher education if nothing is done about the student loan debt crisis? Do we return to the time when only the privileged can attain a college degree? Or I think you know what that person means, or that the cost is not burdensome on low-income folks and low-wealth folks. What happens to the rest of the workforce, given that good jobs increasingly require college degree? That's a great question. What happens if nothing is done here? And we'll go Marshall, Beth, and close out with Braxton.
Yes, I think that's a great point. And the answer is things stay the same, which means getting worse. So institutional segregation gets worse. I think the questioner is saying that essentially, you know, more disadvantaged people will be priced out of the higher education system altogether, and it becomes an elite enclave of the rich. And I think that's basically right. A more acute way of putting it is that the best resourced, highest prestige institutions become even more gated communities for the rich. And those are the credentials that sort of unlock the elite type job. So you have a more stratified society that has conditioned access to the elite more and more on having attended institutions that are transforming their business models to really exclude the disadvantaged students and solely promote the most advantaged students as well as scholars. So there's just a huge amount of institutional segregation in the U.S. higher education system already. We know that that's the case from lots of different research about this. And I would say, you know, nothing changes that. That is what gets worse. So worsening outcomes at poorer, less resource institutions that serve disadvantaged populations, and better outcomes for people who are somehow able to claw their way into the best. And the way, I mean, when I say, use the term claw their way in, it's because, you know, that's because they, you know, they know their admissions director because their parents friends with him at the country club or something like that.
And quickly, what how can people get in contact with you on Twitter?
My Twitter handle is econ_Marshall. And I look forward to seeing you there.
Beth, that question, what happens if we do nothing?
So, you know, I think it's untenable to do nothing. I think there actually is demands intervention. I think both sides of the aisle are in agreement on this. It's just a matter of time before something gives. I suppose that doesn't happen. I will give a more optimistic prediction of the future, just for the sake of balance. I think one direction that we're moving in that is positive is around information. So historically, when you all and I went to college, we didn't have the information that would help us make a good bet financially on our degree. That has changed. So students today have the potential, if we arm them with the knowledge to do so, to make decisions that minimize the chance that they're going to end up in a position of having debt that's unaffordable to them. That ultimately can put downward pressure on prices so that institutions have to respond either by delivering more value to their to their students or lowering prices. So I think in the ideal textbook economics world, that's what we would see happening as a result of this trend of more information and hyper focus on these issues of individual finance and higher education.
Braxton Brewington, close us out with some thoughts on what happens if we do nothing.
So I think either way, we're going to get cancellation. I think if Joe Biden cancels it now, we'll get cancellation. If he doesn't do anything, debtors will cancel student debt ourselves, because debtors will get organized, where the Debt Collective has the nation's first debtors union. What you're going to see is mass people engaging in economic disobedience, where people are going to go on debt strike, as a lot of folks already are now. So people are going to simply politicize their refusal to pay back student loans. Our book is called Can't Pay, Won't Pay. So I think what we're seeing right now is a lot of people who can't afford to pay, and soon people will start saying, fine, I won't pay because this debt is illegitimate. So I think either way, I'm going to propose we will get cancellation.
Well, this has been a wonderful event. I want to thank Marshall, Beth, and Braxton for their wonderful contributions. Also, Carl and Braxton as well, and Senator Schumer for making this a wonderful conversation. I encourage all of you to continue to engage by using the hashtag student debt. And I forgot, Beth, what's your hashtag?
Dr. Beth Akers on Twitter.
Braxton, what's your Twitter handle?
I'm going to plug the Debt Collective, which is @StrikeDebt on Twitter.
And I'm Andre Perry. You can reach me at AndrePerryEDU. And I want to thank you on behalf of the entire Brookings team. We had a great folks in the background doing behind the scenes, Karen and others who are just doing a phenomenal job. Please stay on top of this issue. Read the reports. We'll make sure we tweet those out. And again, thank you for joining us on this, for this wonderful conversation.